This is the Shades of Literature Book Club, and tonight we will be having our first discussion of The Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison. All right. So I want to start by going into the prologue. I don't know if everyone read the prologue, or even if you did or didn't. We can just talk about it a little bit. So in this section of the book, Ralph Ellison sort of establishes the narrator, this narrator that has an unknown name, as the primary figure throughout this book. Some would even say the protagonist. And this narrator is talking in the prologue, and he's describing himself as an invisible man, which of course is the title of the book and a theme throughout the entire book. But he really sinks into being invisible and what that means to him in this prologue. And so I just wanted to open it up and ask you all, what do you think he was trying to say with the invisible man description? And what does that mean to you all?
Okay, well, I'll say that I feel like I identified a lot with the narrator in the sense that I don't necessarily feel invisible, but because I'm so quiet and oftentimes, like, I'm shy and I don't like public speaking, people tend to, I guess, not see me as clearly. They don't really understand me as a person. So I feel like I just, I get where he's coming from. Because, like, no, you're not physically invisible. But, of course, you may feel quite misunderstood sometimes.
Definitely. Valid point. I think it can have multiple meanings, you know. But, again, anyone else want to chime in on that, what they think he means by the invisible man?
I connected this with the story that came up where it was, like, a black mom and a black child, and then this lady that was white, she reached over the black child to get something out of the grocery store, and the black mom was like, "You didn't see my child." And I created the analogy between the prologue and that, between the fact that most often black women in general can be overlooked or invisible in certain, in a lot of circumstances, subconsciously.
I agree. And I just want to read something real quick that I read offline, and it sort of resonated with what I felt he was saying in terms of being an invisible man, which is, according to Ralph Ellison in Invisible Man, to be invisible means to be construed by others as a collection of general stereotypes rather than an actual individual person. And I think that in his story that he shared in the prologue, about this white man that he encountered, and the white man said, like, a racial slur or said something to him, and he just snapped, you know, and he kind of tackled this guy, put, like, the knife to his neck and all this stuff, and he was ready to take his life until he really realized that the guy, in terms of what he said, the guy didn't really see him for who he was, and he saw him for, obviously, his skin color, for being black, and for everything that came with that stereotype before he even realized that this narrator is an individual person and a human being. And so that's what I kind of got. That was my first take on the invisible man and what that means to the narrator. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's kind of vague because it can mean a lot of things. It's not just about skin color. Like, you can be invisible to others depending on your sexual identity, depending on your, you know, political ideology. Someone can use that to literally create a frame for you, and that's how they see you in every aspect of life. So it's my take on that. Anyone else want to chime in on that invisibility?
I think it was really interesting because, like, in the prologue, when he is describing his interaction with a white man and, like, how, you know, it really didn't matter. Like when I was reading it, it kind of, like, related to, like, how I view some of, like, my colleagues that try to, like, not necessarily impress white people, but try to do things to kind of get away from, like, their blackness, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, people that, like, buy these big houses and, like, you know, they really value their educations. They do all these things so that they become visible. But I think, like, what Ralph Ellison was really doing was taking the invisibility and making it, like, kind of, like, relating it back to, like, bare bones thing, right? So it's, like, it's not about, like, what you do. It's not about, like, your talents, accomplishments, or anything that you contribute to society. Like, racism and prejudice and how people view you, it's so beyond just the things that you do, like, in this world and the things that you think you're trying to accomplish. It's so, like, inner that, like, it kind of disturbed me in a way, because, like, sometimes, like, I don't know about y'all, but sometimes I feel like, whether it's in my career or whether it's in, like, grad school or stuff, like, some things are, like, kind of futile, right? So it's like, okay, I can still do all this, but it doesn't matter. Like, people are still gonna see me for, like, my skin color. People are still gonna see me for, like, my sex, like, this and that. So that's how I view it.
Yeah. That's a great view. That's a great view. No, like, not even funny. That was, Cyrus, you want to chime in on that? You actually read my mind, Cyrus, because that was my next point I wanted to bring up, which was, do you feel as though invisibility in the way that the narrator describes can serve as both an advantage and a constant aggravation? Because that's sort of what he talks about there. And I think in terms of seeing it as an advantage, it depends on, one, what you're doing specifically and what your goal is. But taking it back to the context of race, right? Because that was a very specific example and a specific goal that you gave about that movie. But at the same time, I do think in the general sense, and as it applies beyond a specific goal that you're trying to do, it is a constant aggravation, and it is, or it should be considered like a disadvantage, honestly, to me. Because once you achieve that thing, you can't become not invisible. You know what I'm saying? Because of the circumstances, you're always invisible in any space you go to, in a sense. And so, I don't know, I'm thinking high in the sky, but I did find it interesting that he also described it as an advantage. At first, I was reading, I was like, you sound kind of conflicted. Like, do you like being invisible? Do you not like being invisible? Mm-hmm. But what do you guys think?
I think it's like having the underdog. you're no longer the underdogs. But I also think that that creates a very fearless journey to have to fight a stereotype with another stereotype. Like, yeah, I'm invisible, but I'm also smart and too, so now I have to insert another stereotype inside the head for you to still collectively have this idea of me that it's not still holistic.
True.
And I think that that journey of constantly having to prove a new aspect of your identity to anyone is dangerous.
Exactly. You just said it in a better way than I did. exactly. And I also want another point about the prologue. The narrator, unless anybody else wants to talk about that disadvantage advantage thing. Okay, so the narrator, he talks about his experience listening to Louis Armstrong's music, and he says that, he actually says he was under the influence of marijuana. Like, he said he had a cigarette, but it was actually a joint that somebody gave him. And just something I want to bring up real quick to see if anyone had thoughts on it. He talks about the power of Louis Armstrong's music. And he said listening gave him, like, he began to listen and interpret time in a different way when he was listening to the music. And he was saying that he also felt that he was able to better understand, like, Louis Armstrong's invisibility because he was invisible too. And because of the melodies and the messages without even having lyrics behind his music. And I just wanted to pose a question. Do you all often feel that way about any type of music, any, whether it's blues? Because blues is known as this genre of music that really allowed the expression of black folks to come through during that time, especially Jim Crow, where, you know, there was all these feelings, right? We just got freed from slavery, but yet we're still enslaved in terms of laws and policies and things like that. So a lot of that came out through the blues. But in this day and age, do you all feel about that? Do you all feel that same way about any type of music that's out in the market now? Or is it just like that sense of having that deep of a connection with music has sort of died? Or did that resonate with you in any way when he was talking about Louis Armstrong?
Like being able to feel more visible with the music that you're listening to?
I don't even know if the term is visible, but in the way he described it, this is what I got, that he better connected to his identity as an invisible man because of the way because of the music that he was listening to and because of what Louis Armstrong's music made him feel.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He was like, wow, like, I'm an invisible man, but I understand that this guy is too.
Yeah, like, he validated him.
Yeah, whatever is happening in this music, in this weed, in this combination right now, right, is, like, really resonating with me, you know what I'm saying? So, I mean, yours doesn't have to include drugs, but I just wanted to know if maybe anybody feels that same way about any type of music, whether it's blues, or is, like, that a very specific thing to, like, the blues?
The only time I felt like that was probably when I listened to, like, Solange's album. I think because, like, honestly, I think with invisibility, it can honestly feel very isolating, right? Because you're invisible, not everybody really sees you and really understands you. But I think just kind of like with the author and him connecting to Louis Armstrong's music, when I listened to Solange's album, it didn't necessarily take away the feeling of invisibility, but it sort of reminded me that, okay, obviously at the time I was like, I'm invisible, but it does remind you that even in your invisibility, you still do have community of people that do understand what you're going through, and they can also relate, you know?
Right.
Kind of like how, like, not just like with music, but like with just certain like gestures or just certain things that black people universally like can relate to, you know what I'm saying? Like, someone does something crazy and like in a room, you can honestly see like all the black people just like looking at each other. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So like there's certain things where it's like even if you're in a sea of whiteness or in spaces where you don't necessarily feel like your identity or your talent are being appreciated, you kind of know that with like the gestures or even with like certain music or just certain innuendos, like there is still a feeling of community and invisibility.
I agree. I feel like with Ari Lennox in particular, because that's my girl, but like the whole, all the new neo-soul artists, they all speak about my experiences. So even if I did feel invisible, I still may feel invisible, but I know that you're invisible too, and it makes me feel a little more comfortable to know that at least somebody else is going through it. So I feel like in elementary school, when I got detention in school, if somebody else was there, I felt better about it because I know I'm not the only person who misbehaves. I'm not the only person who, you know, you feel better about something when you know that somebody can experience that same thing with you.
Too repetitive. Octavia, you gave some great artists. I feel the same way, you know, by a lot of artists. Common, especially, like nowadays, like Kendrick Lamar. I don't know if y'all listen to like Joey Badass. He's like underground rap kind of guy, but these are just people who definitely like. I like a lot of hip hop in terms of like it varies in hip hop for different situations with me. Like I like club rap, you know, the Migos, Lil Baby, there's a space for all that where I love that, but then I also need to fulfill that void of that space where it's like some more conscious stuff and you're breaking it down from a black man's perspective, you know, in America, facing whatever it is that you're facing, even as a person with millions of dollars, you know, you still are going to be looked at as that black man from whatever hood you came from. So I like when artists can sort of break that down lyrically, and so I agree. I just thought that was an interesting contrast that I wanted to bring in.
I also think it's really interesting because while, like, for example, like, we all, like, relate to certain artists and we can relate not just in our invisibility, but we know that they understand our experiences and stuff like that, I think something that the book really highlights, like, an underlying theme is how much we value different people and how much we value their viewpoints, right? Because although like Solange, like I appreciate her and I'm like, wow, this is so great, another woman who experiences what I'm experiencing, goes through what I'm going through, and I have a community of like other black individuals in science going through what I'm going through, I feel like for a lot of black people, deep down inside, although we have that community, we still subconsciously value the views of white people more, right? So it's something when like a community of people tells you you're doing good, right? So it's like when people win like a BET award, the NAACP award, you're like, okay, this is great. But if someone like were to win or were to be acknowledged by someone of like another race, this and that, exactly, we value it so much more. So it's just interesting to see, like, to kind of dive into the complexity of like, why is it that it's not enough for us to be seen by people who are also invisible like us, which would make us visible to them, right? Why is it that we want to be visible to people that don't necessarily care about us, care about our experiences? Is that human nature? Is our psychology wrong? And I think that's just really like an interesting like undertone of the book, you know? It's like, not only are you invisible, but it's like, why do you even want to be visible to people that don't necessarily really care about you?
I think for us, it's definitely like the psychology, because in America, whiteness is normalized. So we're always trying to compare ourselves to whiteness, no matter what race we are, because that's what we're told to be measured up to.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, you can be great in, you know, in a black space, but it's always going to be compared to whiteness.
Yeah.
It's funny because I had a conversation here, like I'm going to keep repeating that the statement that I can say white, but this one guy was like, because I was like, well, I went to all white schools during elementary and middle school, so like I think I was very prepared when I went to college. And then he was like, well, you think the experience would be the same if I was a white guy that went to an all black school? And I was like, yeah, no, it wouldn't be the same, and you wouldn't feel the same way that I did, because the difference is, if I go to an all-white school and I don't feel valued because of the things that I'm learning in that school and the people that I'm around, when I come home, yeah, I could be valued at home, but the rest of the world and the rest of society still makes white look right. The difference is, you go to school and you don't feel comfortable with all black people. It's okay, because you see yourself on TV in a good way. You see yourself in magazines. Like, you don't see yourself in the same way that I have to still see myself in the rest of the world in the way which that's portrayed. So I think that also plays a role into our own psyches as well. Like, what are we looking at? What are we seeing? What images are we being brought up in? Like, it's not even wrong for us to think that white is right, because that's what we're taught, literally. Like, we've been seeing the Star Spangled Banner since we was like 2 years old, and that's one of the most racist anthems to the world has.
What did you say, Octavia? Are you done?
To speak to what she was saying about being in certain spaces where you have to feel valued and stuff, I never felt that in a sense when going to my undergrad, because my undergrad is a historically black college and university. Mm-hmm. So in that space, you don't necessarily have to prove yourself more than you need to. If anything, you're trying to prove more of yourself, you know, about what more can you do to challenge yourself and not necessarily to be of competition to someone else. Because in that space, you're already valued.
That is true.
Thank you, Cyrus. If everyone's good on that topic, in terms of sharing, I want to move to chapter one, but I do want to say, interestingly, he sort of states at the end of the prologue that, well, he states that the beginning of the story is really the end, which really sort of makes sense. I'm wondering how it's going to make even more sense, but it's like, he talks about the fact that he's invisible, and this is where he's at now in life, and it seems as though the entire book is going to talk about how he's gotten to that point,
mm-hmm.
and the stories of what sort of pours into that. So I thought that was interesting. So chapter one, I'm going to read something really quick. The narrator speaks of his grandparents, freed slaves who, after the Civil War, believed that they were separate but equal, that they had achieved equality with whites despite segregation. The narrator's grandfather lived a meek and quiet life after being freed. On his deathbed, however, he spoke bitterly to the narrator's father, comparing the lives of black Americans to warfare and noting that he himself felt like a traitor. He counseled the narrator's father to undermine the whites with yeses and grins, and advised his family to agree him to death and destruction. Yeah. So that was deep, and that was interesting, and that seems to set the tone of how the narrator sort of moves through life, right? And he also seems conflicted, because for one, he has his grandfather who lived this meek life in terms of just being below the radar after the Civil War. I want no problems, you know. We got this separate but equal thing going on now, and I just wanna be in my little peacefulness and not try to mess with any white people or provoke any white people to infringe on that. But then on his deathbed, he speaks bitterly to his father. The grandfather speaks bitterly to the narrator's father, basically saying, like, the life that I lived makes me feel like I'm a traitor to my people, because I have just been I haven't really had to fight in my heart to keep pushing forward for more rights. I settled with separate but equal, and I've just been living comfortably, or as comfortably as I could with that. And then talking about the undermining whites with yeses and grins and agreeing them to death and destruction. So it just really seems like a conflicting narrator. Now he doesn't know what to do and what to believe, but he chooses to go with that meekness path. So I just wanted to open that up for discussion and see what you all thought about that, his grandfather's perspective, both the life he lived and the advice he gave on his deathbed.
Sometimes meekness can get you killed.
Yes, teacher.
What do you mean by that, Cyrus?
What do I mean? I mean, sometimes kind of just going along with the flow, in a sense, can be, in a sense, not as effective as you think it may be. Like, case in point, I think about the constant discussion that we as black people have when we're discussing Malcolm X versus Martin Luther King and Booker T. Washington versus W.E.B. Du Bois. Both of all four of those men, you know, are in a sense dealing with the whole separate but equal type stance, and they're all looking toward achieving the same goal, but they have different ways and different methods of doing that. And I would say Booker T. Washington and Martin Luther King Jr.'s approach was in a sense more milder. It was more about, you know, let's just kind of work alongside white people to do certain things. Like Booker T. Washington's was like, you know, we can be, I forgot what the quote was, but he was saying we can be as separate as the singularity, but still be all on one end or something like that. Mm-hmm. That was kind of his approach to, in a sense, doing more vocational type skills.
Yeah, economic development.
Mm-hmm. MLK's was, you know, doing demonstrations peacefully, but then you have people like W.E.B. Du Bois who was like, no, we're much more than doing vocational work. We need to start thinking with our minds and being more so intellectuals. Then you have the whole content click concept. Then you think about Malcolm X, when in reality, Malcolm X wasn't necessarily always about, oh, we're just going to kill, shoot up and stuff. It was, no, we're going to take care of ourselves and do what we need to do for ourselves. And if we need to become violent, then we will.
Combating off of what you just stated, I still got another comment on the chat here, but combating off of what you just stated, I think that also in modern day times, that looks like the Jay-Z versus Common. Like, even though both pieces are very essential to progress, I think that analogy of the Malcolm versus Martin is our look at that is now Jay-Z versus Common, although I think they're both
can you clarify what did you say? You said Daisy versus Collins?
Jay-Z versus Colin Kaepernick.
Oh, Jay-Z, girl. I thought you said
Daisy. Oh,
Jay-Z versus Colin Kaepernick. Okay, all right.
Yes.
Side, or the that would be the parallel, because it, from my understanding, and I'm no expert on Booker T. Washington's writings and whatnot, but it was more so like, you know, push economic development, job training, get everybody stable, but it wasn't like with the purpose of being able to make change and becoming like higher than the white race. It was more so just to settle in to the same level. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So, but at the same time, to go back to your question that you posed at the end, I think that crabs in a barrel mentality and the fact that, Cyrus, you mentioned these four great thinkers and philosophers who had these different approaches to how black people should move towards and advance in life and progress and try to find different avenues of civil rights and things of that nature. I think the fact that it's so divisive and instead of like supporting each other, you would get people who would be fully for MLK or fully for Malcolm X and not trying to figure out a bridge between the two. That all goes back to slavery and the fact and literally what this country was built and founded upon, because slaves were, you know, taken from their homes, their families, put against each other in terms of, you know, you can have a child and not see that child for years to come because they get sent to another plantation. And that happened for years and years and years, and then some more years after that. And so it's like, how can you expect a people once given a sense of freedom and then once given, you know, not even given what they're promised, but in increments given rights, to all of a sudden be able to band together and have one single solution to how they should mm-hmm. progress in life. It all diverts back to that. And I'm not saying that it's not possible for black people to come together on things. We've seen that happen. You've seen that happen in each of those individual fights for freedom and equality in the different avenues that you mentioned, Cyrus. But it just all goes back to the fact that it just reminds you of, look at where we were, where we came from, in terms of how we were brought here, how we were divided, how we were stripped of any type of solidarity that, you know, enslaved Africans had in the tribes they came from, and literally made into this crabs in a bucket mentality. That's my point.
I have this scenario that I'm dealing with at work right now. So I had this coworker that I met in my previous unit that I transferred to a new unit. So in this old unit, I had a white friend. We became like best friends. Then she transferred to a unit. And then I happened to transfer to that same unit. But in that unit, she is in a supervisory role.
The white friend?
Right.
Okay.
So now, before I got this promotion, I was right below her. So me and my coworkers in that new unit, all are black. And she's the one white supervisor. So the thing is that all of my coworkers now who are in the same position, they don't like the white girl because now she, they call her a snitch. And she constantly tells on them, you know, if they come in 5 minutes late, if they leave 5 minutes early, she's constantly telling on them. Mm-hmm. So then the problem is, but she's my friend, but they're my friends. And I feel like I'm loyal to them, but I'm also loyal to her. Yeah. And now I'm like having this like back and forth where it's like, I don't know what to do. Should I say something to her? Should I say something to someone higher? I don't know. But the thing is, it's like, I don't know if I'm cruising, like, am I fine because she's not doing it to me? Mm. Or should I say something and stand up for them because I know she's not doing it to me?
No, yeah, it's definitely complex. No, but go ahead, Octavia, go ahead.
But, okay, so that's also a good thing with our community. We gotta understand your professionalism, too, though. Like, you can't be, like, it's a difference if she's only on to, that's the scenario would have to be very individualistic, of course. But it would be like, if she's only talking to the people of color that work in your unit, if she's only getting on them for being 5 minutes late or 5 minutes early, then yes, that is a time to step up. But also if it's only them being 5 minutes late and 5 minutes early, y'all just need to come up. Like that's just pure professionalism though. So like certain things is like I don't get it, because if you were in that same role and you had that same responsibility, you also should hold them to that same standard and that same accountability, level of accountability.
Mm-hmm. She is only doing it to the white people, though. I mean, to the black people.
Oh,
she only does it to the black people. There are people a little bit. Right. Yes. Oh, yeah. It's only black people. And we're always all late.
Yeah.
All of us.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, definitely. Not very like history, but honestly, yeah, I get what you're saying, because, like, obviously you do have a sense of community with your Black coworkers, but this woman was your friend as well. I do think you should probably talk to her, but in the midst of talking to her, you do risk, like, you know, harming that friendship. But if she is being targeted, like, if she is targeting, like, the Black individuals in your, you know, unit, then that is wrong. Even if she doesn't notice it, you know what I'm saying?
I don't think she does.
Exactly. Because sometimes, like, we just associate, like, Black things or, like, things, you know what I'm saying? Like, you grow up saying, thinking, like, okay, like, white is right, Black is wrong. Not even just, like, in terms of, like, skin color, right? Mm-hmm. But just in terms of, like, you know, definitions of the dictionary, just things that you see. If you see, like, a fairy tale, like, you know, the sunny path is always going to be where, like, the good white princess live, but, like, the witch is always dressed in, like, dark things. You know what I'm saying? Right. So she might be subconsciously doing certain things that she doesn't even realize. And I guess if you damage that friendship with her, you still got other friends in the office, so.
But I feel like the father's dad at this point, because it's like, do I just steer straight, and do I just, you know, worry about myself, or do I stick up for my coworkers?
Exactly, and that's a really good real-time example of bringing that up. If at any time you have anything to say, and I'm continuing, just pop in there and just stop me, because I don't want to, you know, not have your comment heard. So, I think, Octavia, you did say you have something to say first, and then Cyrus, you go ahead.
Okay, so coming back to the granddaddy, I think for me, when I read that part about the granddaddy, it reminded me of my grandfather, because my grandfather was born in the 1920s, and so, like, you knew through the first generation, separate but equal, even before separate but equal, like, when wars were still going on and everything. And so, me growing up having to hear all of those stories, I was like, I was infuriated every time I went to school and saw a bunch of white people. But his best friend was also another white guy, so I had to draw the parallels. Like, how are you able to be? How is this possible as a kid? Obviously, now I'm a girl, I get it. But and so when his grandfather is talking to him about these things, I drew the relationship to how my grandfather talked to me about these things, and like the type of advice that I would get versus don't just like yeses and grins to like white people. Where my grandfather was more like, get an education, like these are the things that are gonna help propel you in society, versus like don't just suck up to white people in a sense. Like his best friend was a white guy, and I think that model friendship and that model behavior for me really set that pathway for the rest of everything else as well. Like it did in the book, setting the foundation for the way in which the narrator thinks. Like, it's what molds my every decision. I'm like, dang, am I upholding the responsibility that I have being able to know history and also being able to have the advantage of having the opportunity to a higher education?
Thank you, Octavia.
Cyrus, did you want to say something?
I wanted to relate back to what Maya was saying about her coworkers. And I understand that you're in a sticky spot, but something that kind of struck my mind was, while you're in a sense being loyal to them, are they being loyal to you? And is specifically the girl, would she be loyal to you in a sense to, you know, not necessarily report you? Because that's also a thing that I've also read in books like these that we're discussing, as well as just what I've seen in life and what I know, is that at times, you know, white people, they smile and keep you in your face, but the minute you step out of line, they report you and you don't even know it.
Yep.
And I think going back, just to, like, bring it back to, like, the scene with, like, the grandfather, I think, one, the narrator felt conflicted, because you don't, like, you know, you don't just change, like, a way of thinking, like, immediately, right? Like, your grandfather's on his deathbed saying all this stuff, and you're not automatically like, oh, yeah, white people, like, okay, I know how to act now, right? Yeah, yeah. So, like, he probably was going through his mind and saying, like, dang, like, you lived this entire life, but now on your deathbed you want to regret it, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think, like, with the grandfather, I think part of his frustration came with a realization of understanding that separate but equal, that meekness that he abided by, mm-hmm. it wasn't real, you know what I'm saying? Like, separate but equal is not equal, right? If people and their resources are drastically different, right? It limits opportunities, it limits a lot of things to reach your potential. And I think as human beings, if we feel stifled, or if we feel like we can't reach our, like, our maximum potential because of systemic resources, I feel like we're bound to feel frustrated, like the grandfather did. But I guess, like, also, especially with individuals that, like, survive slavery and they transition into this new freedom state, you're constantly, like, comparing to back in the day, right? You're like, at least I'm not, like, a slave. At least I'm not this. At least I'm not that. But, you know, going throughout your life and making, like, a decent living and avoiding danger and avoiding, you know, the consequences of dealing with white people, that's not necessarily really living. You know what I'm saying? And I think towards the end of your life, if you realize that you haven't reached your full potential, if you haven't lived, you start understanding that, like, a lot of the things that you believed back in the day were wrong, right?
Yeah.
And I think with the narrator, I think, like with a lot of young people, like when we get advice from, like, our grandparents, our parents, it's hard for you to understand that if you haven't necessarily, like, experienced that regret of understanding, like, oh my goodness, like, this isn't really how I want to live, or this isn't really how I want to reach my full potential in the world and things like that. So that's what I took from that scene.
Mm-hmm. And going off what you said about living a rather meek and submissive lifestyle to avoid the conflict with white people, we see very early on how that actually turns out for the narrator. So it says, the narrator recalls delivering the class speech at his high school graduation. The speech urges humility and submission as a key to the advancement of Black Americans. It proves such a success that the town arranges to have him deliver it at a gathering of the community's leading white citizens.
That's great.
Right? And then I'm just going to see, you know, who remembers or who wants to talk about it. What happens when he gets there?
Okay, first of all, that scene was crazy. That was the first scene where I literally took the book and I closed it. So I was like, what's happening?
That's crazy.
So, like,
that's what I did.
Okay, so I'm just going to, like, talk to y'all. What do you say?
Even before that.
So, like, I'm just going to talk through it with y'all. So, like, he gets there. There's a whole bunch of other Black boys. Mm-hmm. They're fighting it out. There's this white woman in the ring. Like, and, like, they fight. And then, what's it called?
The electric rug.
Where did the electric rug come from? And then, at the end, he still delivers a speech. Mm-hmm. I really did not understand the purpose of that. I get it, but, like, I really did not understand why he had to start off the book like that. Like, I was very...
I'm hoping that there's a metaphor later that relates to that later, because I just still don't get it.
I still don't.
Like, he could have just given the speech in humility.
it was interesting because, like, I guess, like, maybe something the author wanted to highlight. I remember, like, in the book when he was giving his speech and he was talking about, what is it, like, social, remember that word?
Responsibility.
Mm-hmm. And then, like, he replaces it with equality. Mm-hmm. Like, it was, like, this whole, like, big thing. Mm-hmm. But honestly, if y'all understand that section of the book a little more, it's
well,
really good.
I'll say this. Well, real quick, Octavia, I'll say this. I think that Ralph Ellison, he doesn't like to make his comparisons or things where you can draw a comparison clear as cut. I think he wrote the book to just kind of leave it open for whatever comparison you feel like you can draw at certain places. So I mean, this is going a little further, jumping further, and I won't go too far, but I actually compared this instance of all the white men, you know, bringing these Black boys together for, like, a battle royale, and then having them, you know, look at this naked white woman, some saying look, some saying, you know, threatening them if they look, and then trying to make them trip into the rug, and all of that weirdness is like
I said weird. Sorry.
All of that bundled together is like a metaphor of like white people looking at black people as like this form of entertainment or this form of they brought them here to be entertained. It's like a show. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? And you can kind of see that that same tendency in Mr. Norton. Mm-hmm. We get that far, but he's the trustee. I'm just gonna leave it there because I know Cyrus, you didn't get that far.
I just don't want
to spoil it. But you know, it's just that general theme of like here's the narrator thinking he's gonna deliver this speech that he really believes in, and because of how his grandfather lived his life, he believed that this works and this is how black people need to live. And he gets in front of all these white people, and it's literally like make a fool of yourself so we can laugh at you. And then still give your speech about being socially responsible because that's what we want.
Right.
There was something I wanted to read. But I know, Octavia, you had something to say. We're not going to move on from this yet.
When I read that, just about Battle Royale, I was like, okay, so either this is a metaphor to like them seeing us as animals. So when we continuously keep each other down, like this is what just looks like, but on paper. And then when I read, when he still gave the speech at the end, that shook my heart because I didn't think we was going to get to that part. When he still gave the speech at the end, I drew a parallel to, I gave a speech in fifth grade when they did like Tropicana speeches in class about NAACP. And I did it in my class. I went to all the levels of speeches, and at the final round, I didn't win the speech. I didn't win the contest. And so I knew my grade gave a great speech. But I felt defeated. I was a fifth grade. And so one of my teachers told my mom, she was like, she gave a great speech. She should have won that award. And my mom was like, well, why do you think she... My mom's a little inquisitive. She knew why. But she was like, well, why do you think she didn't win? And then she was like, honestly, I think it was because of her topic. At that, in fifth grade, I didn't understand what that meant at the time, but like obviously later on, I got what it was. Because to me, I was speaking about the NAACP because my grandfather often talked about the NAACP, so it was something that I wanted to research on, and this was a perfect opportunity to research on it and talk about it. But that, the feeling that I felt like after I started to understand what those lines meant, is the same thing that I looked at when I read this book, and I was like, he's about to give a speech in front of a bunch of white people, like, about social responsibility and what that means to him as a black male or black narrator in this sequence.
And large sections of the speech came directly from Booker T. Washington's Atlanta Exposition address. So you can see that this is someone that the narrator is looking up to, you know, at least in the early chapters of the book.
You know what? After hearing kind of like y'all's interpretation of the scene, I guess now, not that I still understand why all that happened, but specifically after hearing Brandon's response, I guess that also kind of makes me think now about not like the music industry, but the sports industry. You know what I'm saying? And like all these like black boys, kind of like the narrator, trying to get into sports for like the right intentions, you know what I'm saying? Like to provide a better, you know, home for their family, to like, you know, do all these things. When like really a lot of times like sports is just us watching a whole bunch of like not just black people, but a lot of times mostly black people really get into these you know, strenuous situations for our entertainment, you know what I'm saying? And how, like, the narrator, they go into it with, like, the right intentions, right? Because they love the sport, this and that. But at the same time, like, you know, it's not... I don't even know what I'm trying to say, but that's the only way that scene makes sense. Like, trying to relate them to some sort of, like, sports entertainment, that's,
I get you. And as a sports fan, you know, that's difficult, but it's not... When I say difficult, it's like I hear that, but then I still watch it. Mm-hmm. But it's like it becomes an issue when it's owned. These teams are owned by white men, and it becomes another issue when they move around players or they make decisions disregarding the player's well-being. Mm-hmm. That's when it really seems like it's in relation to, like, this scene. Like, mm-hmm. How can you, you know, these are the players, these are the people that love this sport and that will make you millions of dollars, but literally at the snap of a finger, you know, because you, whatever it may be, you need a new facility or something, anybody can be gone. It's still owned by whiteness. And so that's what makes it uncomfortable.
I was also thinking that it could just, this is reach, but it could be like how far black people are willing to go to be respected by whiteness in general. So, I mean, you're willing to go through all of this just to present something to white men so they can see you in a higher, in a higher way. And it's just like, why go through all of that?
But did he know
you could just leave.
That he was going to be in that situation? Or did he arrive and was surprised?
He might arrive and was surprised, but he still gave the speech. Now, I don't know if he felt as though he had no choice at that point.
It made no sense why he still gave that speech.
You know, it's like, and then, wait, Cyrus, did you have something you wanted to say?
I remember reading, and I know that not only did he not know that he was getting in this situation, but once he got in the situation and realized that he would have to be fighting the other black boys, I believe the narrator like tried to tell one of the other black boys, like, I'm not really gonna hit you, but pretend like you're hurt. But they were having none of that.
Yeah.
So I thought that was interesting too, how like, okay, yeah, he might have been oblivious going in, but he still didn't want to hurt like his fellow like black men.
Mm-hmm.
But they like, it kind of relates back to that crab in the barrel mentality of like,
yeah,
they were trying to win at all costs.
Mm-hmm.
So I found that really interesting how the narrator is so oblivious, so naive, but when he still sees someone that looks like him, he still tries to extend an olive branch and say, okay, like, let's somehow be in this together.
Mm-hmm.
But none of them were having that.
Yeah.
You know,
that was, I didn't even think about that, so that was an interesting point you brought up. Rob Ellison just puts in all these themes.
He can never just say anything.
But I want to say, interestingly, right, after that's all said and done, and kind of moving into chapter two, he finishes the speech, right? He makes a mistake. They say, what? He says, oh, I meant social responsibility. Oh, okay. Stand up and clap when he's done. And then they award him this calfskin briefcase.
Mm-hmm.
And instruct him to cherish it, telling him that one day its contents will help determine the fate of his people. Right? And he has utter joy, and inside it, he opens it up and finds a scholarship to the state college for black youth. What y'all think about that?
Man, it goes back to just black leadership in general. You know what I'm saying? If, like, you have, like, certain black leaders that were taught, like, for example, it kind of goes back to the whole Martin Luther King thing and all that we were talking about previously. Not saying, like, obviously, like, those leaders didn't go through, like, the specific experience that the narrator went through. But if you have, like, certain black leaders that, like, not saying that they pander to, like, the white community and white leaders, but they don't necessarily fully understand, like, who they are, like, in the sense that they're invisible, they do determine the fate of our race, right? Because even though, like, white men don't view them as equal, they still get into the proximity of the resources and the power of whiteness, right? And because we equate whiteness with just being good and kind of like that standard that we uphold, when they come, like, after they graduate and after they, you know, go off to college and be successful, when they come back to the community, because they've been in the proximity of whiteness, we view them as our leaders, and they shape how we make our decisions. They shape how we move. They shape how we interact with whiteness and how we limit ourselves and how we view the things that we want to do in the future. So it's just interesting because when they say, you know, the content, like, you know, what's in this briefcase is going to determine your people's future, it is, right? Because him going to college and him being in that proximity of whiteness and learning how to, you know, speak and just do certain things that, like his people didn't know how to do, and then him coming back to the community, it just makes this cycle of, like, just being captive to, like, this whole, like, white mentality that he didn't even know that he, you know, was subject to in the beginning.
I think that, yes, Stacey did a really good job. I actually cannot come back from that. I'm good.
Okay. And I also want to say, right, so there's that point. And then next, before it goes to chapter two, it says that he has a dream of going to a circus with his grandfather and there's clowns. But the main point of it is, he in the dream, he opens the briefcase and he opens an envelope and another envelope and another envelope. And the last envelope, it says, to whom it may concern, keep this nigger boy running. All right? And then he wakes from the dream with his grandfather's laughter ringing in his ear. But that still doesn't deter him from going off and having the same mindset that he has. So, but that dream, in my opinion, is like the first glimpse of, like, this isn't, like, all that it's going to be cracked up to be. This meekness, this just take this golden ticket that the white man has handed you after putting you through hell, and it's going to be all good. So he has this dream, but it doesn't faze him. He continues on into chapter two, where we start to hear about the college and stuff. So,
God.
So unless there's a point on that, I'm going to move on into chapter two. All right, hearing none. They say in sentence. So, the college. I think it opens up talking about the college's founder, who was a black man, and you hear a lot more about that black man later, but the donors, a majority of the donors and some of the trustees are white men, one of them being Mr. Norton. And so apparently, like, the narrator takes this job from one of the deans to drive around Mr. Norton. And, you know, Mr. Norton's talking, he's giving his life spiel, and he wants to see around, right? And I guess the narrator has to decide where he's going to take him to stall and to be able to show him around a little bit before he goes to the meeting that he has to go to. And apparently he decides to take him to, like, the slave cabins, or what the what used to be slave cabins, but now I think they said sharecroppers were living there, which is people who couldn't afford better housing.
Slavery.
Slavery. Yeah, right? And so,
That's just another form.
So,
my grandfather was a sharecropper. Yeah, that's definitely a form of slavery.
Exactly. And as is convict leasing, but that's another conversation. But, so, he's driving him around, and then this story comes up about True Blood. Do y'all remember True Blood?
Oh, and
so this was all weird, but the first question I want to ask is, what would y'all have done in that situation? Right? So you have this person who apparently is a very important white man in the car, and he's saying, oh, we have to stall. Okay, so drive me around a little bit. Let me see. Okay, well, where should I take you? Well, I want to see these, you know, cabins over here, and he asks about True Blood. He's inquiring about all these things that the narrator knows is a sketchy, you know, avenue to move into. What would y'all have done? Would y'all have been like, oh, you know, I don't care what you say, we're not going over here. We can go anywhere else, but I'm not going to take you over here. Or would you have complied? Because that seems to be Dr. Bledsoe's question at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just curious as to what you all, and I'll share what I think I would have done as well.
You know, it's strange, right? Because, like, I feel like all of us, because, like, of the generation we are in and, like, our experiences, we're not as naive as a narrator, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think part of us all know that a lot of times white people don't really want to see, like, the truth, right? They love, for example, like, donating to programs like CARE or, like, just scholarship programs, mm-hmm. and painting a picture of what their money and what their contributions are, like, doing to, like, mm-hmm. you know, the lives of all these people, you know what I'm saying? And I think if I was a narrator, because of my personal experiences, kind of like, I never knew how to pronounce his name, Dr. B.
Bledsoe. I thought it was Bledsoe.
Yeah. Kind of like Dr. Bledsoe said, because of my experiences and because of my interactions with white people, I would have manipulated the situation so we wouldn't have been there. You know mm-hmm. what I'm saying? Just because, like, I knew, I personally would have known, like, although he thinks he wants to see, like, the truth, and he thinks he wants to really understand. Yeah, like, I know, like, you really don't. You know what I'm saying? You kind of want, like, your money and your resources to go to this kind of, like, fantasy world.
Yeah.
So, personally, I think I would have steered away from it, but I think it's because of my experiences with white people.
Mm.
I think if I was as naive as a narrator, maybe I would have made the same decision, thinking, like, oh, maybe he wants to, like, hear the truth. Maybe he really wants to, like, investigate the town, see what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But because of my personal experiences, we would not have been in that situation, unfortunately.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I agree with Stace. I would have been like, my name Bennett, and I ain't never seen this on the town. But like you said, that also stems from the fact that we're an Obama generation. Like, we're part of the Trayvon Martin generation. Like, we literally just know more, and we've seen more. But I've been in that situation at Florida State where I'm like, nope, I have no idea what racism is, never heard of the definition, because I still need to donate the chair. Like, you know, there are certain things that you just don't put at the risk of your people. And when it's greater than just the individual experience or what that little moment could be like, you got to think about that and be like, cool, I attend.
Cyrus, I thought I heard
him.
You know, I also want to say about Mr. Norton something I forgot to say. This guy is kind of interesting, right? In his explanation of why he supports the college so much. Mr. Norton believes that African Americans need saving from generous white men like himself. He funds the college out of an absurd pursuit of legacy, claiming that his destiny is tied up with that of the students. He kept saying, like, your success is he kept saying, like, something along the lines of, your success is like my destiny. You're connected to me. I am connected to you. Like, I am invested in, like, you succeeding for some sort of strange self-fulfillment purposes. I just found that all the way off. It just didn't seem genuine. It seemed like he was pouring so much money into the college for the success of black people for some self-fulfillment of himself, or to justify some sort of guilt that he had as a white person. Mm-hmm. I definitely felt that Ralph Ellison was trying to give like a bigger picture with that. I don't know exactly what it is yet. I just want to throw that opinion out there. If anyone has something to add to that, feel free to cut me off. But so they're driving around, and then he wants to hear from this guy, Trueblood, Mr. Norton wants to hear from this guy, Trueblood, who the narrator explains is like this man who had incest sex with his, I guess, was it daughter, and then impregnated her with a daughter. And so because of that, the college and all the black people from the college basically shunned this man. But white people showed him even more support after that happened. Apparently it happened. He woke up from a dream. He explained it as he woke up from a dream and he was having sex with his daughter, and then that's how that happened. But he was just saying, oh, I find it odd that so many white people have given me more support and more money after that very shameful act has happened. And Mr. Norton's in the back listening, fascinated, and he's like, oh, take me to him. I don't care. Take me to him. I want to hear this from his mouth. And then again, that's sort of what I was talking about, the contrast with that Battle Royale. It's just like the comparison of just this entertainment. Like, I don't think Mr. Norton had any intentions of like going to him to like help or to be like, you know, I'm really concerned for your situation. Mm-hmm. It was more so like, I just want to hear this for myself. Yeah, right? And then he actually ends up giving him money at the end. He gave him $100, I think. Like, he didn't even have any words. He just gave him $100, which is the same thing that all the other white people did when they probably heard the story. Because I'm not even going to lie, Trueblood, he's like a good storyteller. Like, the way he was explaining it, he was just like really going off, you know? And so, thoughts on that? I mean, it was just like, thoughts on Trueblood, for one, and what you think about this strange story about him waking up from a dream and doing this? Do you think that it was, is that a lie, or is that actually something that even makes any sense? And then thoughts on Mr. Norton just being like, bet, that was amazing, and then giving him $100.
Not bad.
And then being like, narrator, take me to go get a drink because I'm about to pass out.
Like, just so many things went wrong.
Okay, yeah, so many things.
Like,
he woke up and more white people were helping him than black people, I think I draw that parallel though to the fact that of like what we value differently. Like amongst the black community, in my opinion, I feel like we value reputation and materials way more than we do life. And so whereas I think in that community they saw, okay, life was still, although this is a horrific circumstance, life was still brought into the world, like, we're gonna help you. Whereas amongst the black community, they're like, yeah, but you just ruined the reputation of the college, you just ruined the reputation of us, like, we're gonna scrutinize you a lot more than the other counterparts would. And I think that also, like, comes to, like, that social responsibility that we have on ourselves as well. Like, that's such a sad thing that someone else has to say that, like, another community provided for me more than my own community did in the time of me. But it's like we have to use proper discernment and judgment as to when to scrutinize more than when to help out.
Definitely. And you know something? That actually reminds me of
10%, Brandon.
I'm on 10%.
Yes.
Brandon, charge me.
She gonna have the switch. Where she gonna sit?
I thought there was a plug. No. I might be able to charge you on my laptop.
I can
put you up to my laptop, but I just want to say this. I think that in some way, shape, or form relates to this whole Gil King situation that recently happened, where you gotta wonder, like, well, I just you know, I feel like a lot of times black people, we jump to a conclusion in terms of how to express our dissenting opinion, and it goes too far. But sometimes it might not even be because of that's how we really feel, but it's because of everything else we're seeing. Like, all this, if you go on social media one day and you see like five tweets talking about this terrible thing that Gil King said in the wake of Kobe Bryant's death, or like something that she asked in an interview, and you're a huge Kobe Bryant fan, you're black, you might get hyped up and just start going and tripping off on Gil King. But, and then not even, or if you just see the clip that, what was it, CBS posted, and not the full interview, then you just get to tripping. And I think it's that, what you said, Octavia, it's like, you gotta understand when to, there's a situation to trip, when there's a situation to give a well-thought opinion, because, well, first of all, to do your research before giving that well-thought opinion, and then giving it...
Yeah, because some people ain't see either interview.
Yeah, and then giving it in a way that's not tearing down someone's career and life, and then when there's a time to support. And I think that when you don't do that, and you just kind of jump to a conclusion quickly, we saw the effect, right? You know, Gail King was walking around here with security guards and trying to...
It's not funny.
And literally fearing for her life. So, so I think that's an interesting point to compare that to.
But I also think, kind of like going off of Octavia's point where... you know, kind of mentioning like, oh, like other communities are more willing to help us more than our own community, right? I think the actions weren't genuine, right? I think because True Blood represented like another stereotype or just some deformed and not real, you know what I'm saying? Like character or like, yeah, like a caricature or just someone like that white people would look at and be like, yeah, that is a black person.
Right.
I think they were more able and more willing to be like, okay, here's money, this and that. Like, you know what I'm saying?
Ooh. Yeah.
I'm still on 10%.
No, we look at something else.
How does that work?
Oh, you can. Cyrus, Maya's getting a call. She might have to put you on hold.
Oh, no, just click the decline.
Oh, okay.
No, I don't know.
I'm going to run and get my charger real quick.
Oh wow, you live downstairs? Look at you. Downstairs living. Sorry. Brandon's going to get his charger. Wait, actually, I'm gonna use a bathroom. Hold on. But I still have a quick
break.
I'm gonna use, yeah, it's a break. Brandon, is the bathroom right here?
Yeah, it's locked.
Oh. Oh wait, can I use, wow, look at your room. You're so organized. You got a bookshelf in here?
Impromptu break. I want to keep you out here all night on Friday night. So
what time is it?
It's like
8.
Oh, no,
that's me. It's like probably like 8:10, but we're going to combine chapters 2 and 3.
Actually, I had a thing to say about that one thing.
Okay,
so I think that white people...
We're on a little break, though, because they... Don't you guys...
She can still hear me. So I think that white people love to support anything that makes black people look like the way that they want us to look or the way that they describe us to look. So, like, Omarosa. They love to support her because, you know, that's who they expect a black Republican to be.
Yeah. I agree. I think what you just said combined with Stacey's comment about True Blood is like, he seems like this person that's not even real. Like, what are you talking about, man? You had to woke up from a dream.
Hold on, break it down a little bit. I see nothing but the
room. Okay, hold on. I had to put you on a charger real quick.
Okay.
Yeah. Dang. I don't know if it's going to work. My phone is tripping on my laptop. Let's see. One second. See y'all later.
Bye.
tired. I'm joining the book club next week, man.
Yeah, I know. I'm just trying to hook you up on Tinder so you don't die.
You got a black room in here? That's crazy.
Or tell Stace to call me.
What happened?
Stace's phone is recording. But I got a long charger. And so I think you can make this work.
I don't want to die.
We don't.
But,
I'm probably gonna wash my hair tonight. I just looked up. I feel you. Just be careful. You know what I'm saying? Probably Sunday. I'm probably gonna procrastinate it. No, seriously. I'm gonna put deep conditioner tonight though, so it can like saturate overnight. Yeah. All right. Okay. Yeah, but like I was saying, white people aren't genuine. They contribute to things because it further, like, you know, confirms like a stereotype in their mind. You know what I'm saying? Whereas like black people, I think like, what's going on? I think one of the reasons why the college shunned him so bad was because like as black people, we are always trying to get away from like stereotypes. To see someone kind of like just do something that was so like primal, so wrong. I think the college didn't necessarily want to shun him to be like, you know, mean and negative. I think they were just trying to distance themselves from them so he wouldn't be associated.
Feel free to grab the water.
So they wouldn't be associated, you know what I'm saying? Because, like, think about, like, for example, like, if you're, like, just walking around, like, living your life. Like, let's say, for example, like, you're at brunch, right? And, like, this black couple gets into like a fight, right? You automatically say, please, not the black people. You know what I'm saying? You always want to distance yourself because deep down, like, you don't want to be seen as a stereotype. You don't want to be seen as a certain thing. You know what I'm saying? Whereas, like, white people, they might take out their phones and start recording because it just entertains them. But it doesn't necessarily mean that they're actually being, like, supportive. You know what I'm saying? They just might, yeah, they just like the entertainment. They just like, you know, you fulfilling a stereotype. It's funny to them, you know?
Yeah, I think that financial contribution aspect of it plays into that white savior mentality.
Oh, yeah.
That, like, oh, I'm saving you from something because I'm able to give you something that your rightful community can't give you as well.
Definitely. Sorry, is she still hanging in there?
I'm still hanging in there.
Okay. And I said we was going to merge chapter 2 and 3. So the next thing, or one of the last things I really want to hear everybody's opinion on is, so the narrator, in the course of poor decisions as to where to take Mr. Norton, decides he needs a drink, he's about to pass out, I'm about to take him to the Golden Day, which is apparently this bar where a lot of veterans hang around. It's also a brothel, with, you know, where people come to see prostitutes or sex workers. And so... they enter this place, a brawl breaks out, things start to go crazy, and then this particular veteran helps Mr. Norton, and helps the narrator take Mr. Norton upstairs because he's like having some health issues or whatnot. But I want to talk about this veteran because he kind of just lays it out like in a way that we haven't heard yet or seen yet in this book. So, the particular veteran claims to be a doctor and a graduate of the college, and after Norton wakes, the veteran mocks his interest in the narrator and the college. He says that Norton views the narrator as a mark on his scorecard or achievement rather than as a man, and that the narrator thinks of Norton not as a man, but as a god.
Period. And that's the book.
Right, so this vet is just like, right, he almost embodies like the ultimate critique of like the narrator's love for just Booker T. Washington and the we're gonna fit in, we're gonna be equal. And he says that you literally look at Mr. Norton like a deity. So what do y'all think about this guy? And he also says in a crazy way, like, he's like, I can relate because I hear the audible, and the guy who reads this book does like every impersonation of everybody.
That's good.
His impersonation of this guy is so funny. Like, he's way out there, but he's making sense. And so, what are y'all thoughts?
Agreed.
Well, we know what it is. Okay. Yeah, and like, I don't want to jump too far ahead in the book, but it's just one of those things where it's like, I think this community got so much going on. I think because of that, I don't even know, was a veteran like in his right mind? Was he in his right mind?
Well, I don't know. I think that's left up to the reader to determine.
Okay.
I mean, there's something later that would make us think that he's not in his right mind, but it could also, anyways, jumping too far ahead. But I don't know. I think that's something for us to
determine.
Right. I just want to make sure
they're not scared. Hey, Brandon. Yeah. No, but I definitely agree. But I also remember in the book after the veteran expressed his thoughts to Mr. Norton, didn't Mr. Norton get angry?
Yeah.
Wasn't he, like, upset?
Yeah,
right?
He got real angry. He demanded for him to be taken, you know, back to the school.
Yeah, and what's it called? That just goes back to what we were saying before. White people really don't want to hear the truth. Mm-hmm. They don't want to they don't want to see life for what it is. You mm-hmm. know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, because they're, just how our perspective has been perverted by certain things, their perspective has also been shifted to ones that's like not realistic.
Mm-hmm.
So I think while the veteran, right, it's kind of like when, like, you know, we try to make points as black people that we know is true, like, oh, crabs in the barrel, this and that.
Mm-hmm.
While the veteran like was right, he was correct, like his sentiments, like him expressing his sentiments, almost didn't matter. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because he still was like shooed away. They still went back to school. And like further on, you kind of know what happens to him after, you
exactly.
know, expressing his sentiments. So.
Exactly. Anybody else want to chime in on that? The vet and his perspective?
I'm like right in the middle of that, so I think so.
Okay, okay. I figured if I was get a little quiet over there, the call. So we're gonna go ahead and wrap up this session, but I think it was a good way to start it off. I think we start to see some of the themes that are building, and as we get deeper into the body of the book, I'm looking forward to seeing how those themes continue, how they change. I'm wondering if the narrator is gonna like switch up, if he's gonna become this person who's like an activist now, or if he's gonna stay the same way, and or if he's just gonna end up like the beginning, which he said was the end, as this invisible man. So. Cool. We can end the official. Cool.